gift-giving. Metal tools largely created slash-and-burn agriculture, William M. Denovan, the Wisconsin geographer, told me. This picture of Sweden as this ancient practice by which Indians kept themselves in a timeless balance with nature, that is mostly or entirely a myth, I think. At least there's no evidence for it, and a fair amount of evidence against it, including the evidence of simple logic. Slash and burn, supposedly a quintessentially Amazonian trait, is a modern intrusion. A similar phenomenon seems to have taken place in North America, where Indians were widely said to have practiced slash and burn as part of their habit of living lightly on the land. Dismissing the data to back up these claims as gossamer, the geographer William E. Doolittle of the University of Texas noted in 2000 that most colonial accounts showed Indians clearing their fields permanently, even ripping stumps out to prevent them from sprouting. Once fields were cleared, the intent was to cultivate them permanently, or at least for very long periods of time. As populations rose, farmers cleared new fields from the remaining forests. Slash and burn was a product of European axes and European diseases, which so shrank Indian groups that they adopted this less laborious but also less productive method of agriculture. In the Amazon, the turn to Sweden was unfortunate. Slash and burn cultivation has become one of the driving forces behind the loss of tropical forest. Although Sweden does permit the forest to regrow, it is wildly inefficient and environmentally unsound. The burning sends up in smoke most of the nutrients in the vegetation, almost all of the nitrogen, and half the phosphorus and potassium. At the same time, it pours huge amounts of carbon dioxide into the air, a factor in global warming. Large cattle ranches are the major offenders in the Amazon, but small-scale farmers are responsible for up to a third of the clearing. Fortunately, it is a relatively new practice, which means it has not yet had much time to cause damage. More important, the very existence of so much healthy forest after 12,000 years of use by large populations suggests that whatever Indians did before Sweden must have been ecologically more sustainable. In the West. In 1977, a Brazilian geography student named Alceu Ranzi got a summer job with the National Program of Archaeological Research in the Amazon Basin. Dubbed PRONAPABA, its Portuguese acronym, the Smithsonian-sponsored program was conducting the first-ever full archaeological survey of Amazonia, which was being logged for cattle ranches at a speed that was beginning to cause protests. To Ranzi's surprise, in his home state of Acre, Brazil's westernmost region, a ranching center, PRONAPABA discovered half a dozen large circular ditches carved into the newly cleared land. PRONAPABA did not formally announce its finding for 11 years, and even then, only in an obscure, unrefereed journal. Meanwhile, Ranzi went on to become a well-respected paleontologist, most recently at the Federal University of Acre, in Rio Branco. On a flight to Acre in 1999, he casually looked out the window at some recently opened land. In clear view was a geometric figure carved into the earth. He had spotted the earthworks again. Recalling his previous work, he began looking for more, driving around ranches, catching rides in private planes. Within a year, he told me, we had found dozens. Shaped like circles, diamonds, hexagons, and interlocking rectangles. The earthworks are 300 to 900 feet in diameter and outlined by trenches up to 20 feet deep. Despite their size, Ranzi had trouble getting people to pay attention. Acre is in the western Amazon, on Bolivia's northern border, the hinterlands of the hinterlands. The highway from the center of the country is impassable for as much as half the year. Plane flights are infrequent and long. A lot of people travel around the state by boat, on the many tributaries of the Amazon. To outsiders, The state is best known for being the home of legendary rubber tapper, union organizer, and anti-deforestation activist Chico Mendez, who was murdered there in 1988. The state's main forest reserve is named after him. To many Brazilians, Acre seems scarcely less remote. When I first visited, a friend in Rio de Janeiro could hardly believe I was going there. Nonetheless, Ronzi kept contacting anyone he thought could help him find out more about the earthworks. To help attract attention, he called them by a catchy name, geoglyphs. Eventually, researchers came to Acre. By 2005, Ronzi was co-leading a research team with Marty Parsonen of the University of Helsinki and Denise Sean of the Goeldi Museum in Belém, near the mouth of the Amazon. 6 years later, the tally of geoglyphs in Acre alone had grown to more than 200. Scores, or even hundreds more, the geoglyphs team said, remain to be found in Acre. The neighboring state of Rondônia, and the adjacent Bolivian department of Pondo. During one of my trips to the area, Ronzi wangled a flight for Sean, himself, and me on a military helicopter. The overflight, which lasted little more than an hour, was enough to discover three more. The purpose of the geoglyphs remains unknown. Nonetheless, Sean told me, their location and size is enough to make them very difficult to fit in with what we thought in the past. Most known geoglyphs are located not near the floodplains, but on higher ground. Sean and Ronzi have estimated that building a single geoglyph 600 feet across would require moving 10,000 cubic yards of earth, a big task without metal tools. Given the labor required for construction and the large number of earthworks, the geoglyphs team has argued that the Acre uplands must have been inhabited for hundreds of years by sizable regionally organized populations. In some sense, the geoglyphs shouldn't be there. The long-lasting crowded populations suggested in Acre are exactly the sort that archaeologists long thought were ecologically impossible. Moreover, they were located not in the floodplains, where the meager soils are replenished by silt and people can fish for proteins, but the uplands, which have so few resources that researchers long believed they were unfit for prolonged habitation. Partly because of these arguments, many ecologists have thought that the uplands, more than 90% of the Amazon basin, must consist of untouched primary forest and savanna, a landscape never painted by the human brush. The geoglyphs suggest something else. Because they cannot be seen through thick forest, researchers believe they must have been constructed at a time when the region had little tree cover. In other words, the great forests of the Western Amazon may have looked considerably different in the not-too-distant past. The geoglyphs are only part of the puzzle. As archaeologists have recently learned, the first inhabitants of the Western Amazon created a swath of earthworks that stretches between the Beni in southeastern Bolivia and Acre in western Brazil. A 700-mile swath of raised fields, canal-like water channels, tall settlement mounds, circular pools, permanent zigzag fish weirs, mile-long raised causeways, and hundreds of earthworks, ranging from simple, irregular ditches in the south to elaborate geometric arrays in the north. According to Clark Erickson, the University of Pennsylvania researcher who invited me to the Beni, the region is a laboratory for historical ecology, a model of how human beings can use even the most apparently unpromising areas to create and maintain environments that match their needs. Traditionally, archaeologists have regarded the wet tropics as unpromising. Because Amazonia has little stone or metal, 99% of material culture was perishable, Erickson told me. Cane, chonta, palm wood, bones, basketry, wood, none of it survives these conditions. The whole culture, even if it was there for thousands of years, seems to be gone. In consequence, he said, archaeologists in the Amazon have been forced to adopt other methods, from soil chemistry to network theory. Instead of working from individual sites, as is traditional archaeological practice, researchers must study entire landscapes. The Beni, where Erickson and his Bolivian colleagues have focused their efforts, is an example. Exceptionally low and flat, much of the department is covered for up to 4 months of the year by a slowly moving wash of water, snowmelt from the Andes and heavy local rainfall, that is as much as 3 feet deep. During the dry season, the water evaporates and the Beni becomes a hot, arid savanna, kept open by annual burning. To avoid the annual flood, Indians lived on slightly raised, forested islands. In the lowest parts of the department, the islands weren't high enough, so people constructed thousands of mounds as dwelling places. Most of the mounds were small, their summits barely topped the water, but a few were 30 or even 60 feet tall. Some are still inhabited by Indian groups. Living on this artificial inland archipelago, native peoples ate a diet heavy in fish, which migrate and spawn in the flooded savannas. Crisscrossing the savanna are networks of earthen fish weirs, interconnected low berms that change direction, zigzag style, every 30 to 100 feet. At the angles are funnel-like openings for nets or basket traps. When the waters receded, the area's original inhabitants ensured that the fish drained into hundreds of artificial fish ponds. Some are still full of fish today. Agriculture was just as intensive. In a broad reach of savanna, the Beni's original inhabitants built raised fields, artificial platforms of soil that lift crops above the floodwaters. Like the raised beds in temperate zone gardens, they promote drainage and increase the amount of topsoil available to plants. The few carbon dates available suggest that the fields date from about 3,000 years ago to about 500 years ago, roughly the time the conquistadors arrived, bringing European diseases. Like any agricultural fields, these were not used forever, Erickson told me. They went in and out of production, which suggests to me that they were looking at a long-term but dynamic system. Because the mounds, weirs, and fields required enormous labor to construct and maintain, Erickson argued that these societies must have had large populations, tens or even hundreds of thousands of people. To move people and goods from place to place, Indians built networks of ruler-straight causeways and canals, some of them 3 miles long. Puzzlingly, the causeways and canals are not present in every area. Are they here just because it's wetter in this place and so causeways and canals are needed? Erickson asks. Why do some people live in the swamp and savanna but use the causeways, and others live on mounds but appear to have no causeways in or out? Even when Indians built causeways, not all mounds are connected to each other, a fact Erickson was hoping to use to decipher the relations between groups. To make sense of the pattern, he and a student, a Wall Streeter who was taking time away from the market to pursue his academic dreams, were trying to apply the techniques of network analysis to search for particularly important nodes in the networks of causeways, canals, mounds, and fields. Initial results showed a few key raised islands in control of a vast network of communication and interaction covering 200 square miles, as large as many early states. Even as archaeologists try to work out how the area's first inhabitants reshaped their physical environment, other scientists are beginning to trace out their impacts in its genetic heritage. According to Charles R. Clement, a botanist at Brazil's National Institute for Amazon Research in Manaus, the Western Amazon was a center for plant domestication, a Vavilov center, as botanists call them. The name comes from pioneering Soviet botanist Nikolai Vavilov, who first noted that plant domestication was concentrated into half a dozen small areas around the planet. Agricultural geneticists have long accepted that the Western Amazon was the development ground for peanuts, Brazilian broad beans, Canavalia plagiosperma, and two species of chili pepper, Capsicum baccatum and C. pubescens. But the list is much longer than that, according to Susanna Hecht, a UCLA geographer who has worked in the region for 30 years. I would add rubber, made from the sap of Hevea brasiliensis, to the list, she told me. Used for countless purposes by pre-Columbian populations, it is at least a semi-domesticate, and it was clearly distributed by humans. Still more important in her view was manioc, Manihot esculenta. The world's sixth most important crop in terms of annual harvest, this large tuber has been fundamental to Amazonian diets for 7,000 years or more. For decades, most researchers believed manioc, like maize, had no wild ancestor. The crop is thought to have arisen from a chance combination of several relatives. In the early 1990s, Brazilian researchers discovered a wild subspecies, M. esculenta flabellifolia, in Rondônia. Soon afterward, Kenneth M. Olson and Barbara A. Schall of Washington University in St. Louis demonstrated that domesticated manioc's genetic endowment was derived from flabellifolia, suggesting the latter was ancestral to it. According to Olson, the subspecies also could occur further west in the Beni, which borders on Rondônia. Nobody has yet looked there. Atop many of the Beni mounds and islands are deep ditches, most of them circular or oval. Analogues of the geoglyphs to the north, they are typically 500 feet across, though some are considerably larger. Because the mounds are usually forested, Erickson and his Bolivian co-investigator, Patricia Alvarez of the Universidad Mayor de San Simón in Cochabamba, have been forced to measure them by chopping through trees and vines. The work can be painfully slow. During one of my visits to the area, Erickson and Alvarez spent most of an afternoon hacking with a machete through thick forest to identify the track of a single ditch on a GPS. Because of the tree cover, nobody knows how many geoglyphs exist. Erickson, for his part, says he wouldn't be surprised if almost every one of the mounds had them. Perhaps backing this view, anthropologist John Walker of the University of Central Florida reported in 2008 that he had discovered ring ditches on the mounds in north-central Bolivia, in an area where they had not previously been reported. We found ceramics on four forest islands that we examined, he told me in an email from Bolivia, and each of them also had earthworks that I am willing to call ring ditches, circular geoglyphs. The relation of the geoglyphs to the other earthworks is unclear. We have one set of people constructing the ring ditches and another set of people constructing the causeways and mounds, Alvarez told me. The question is whether they are the same people. In her view, the variegated cultural landscape of the region probably reflects a patchwork of different ethnic groups working in different areas, with constant, intense, inter-ethnic communication, a crowded, jumbled social landscape that Alvarez thought extended for hundreds of miles in every direction. Researchers in both Brazil and Bolivia think it likely that the geoglyphs extend continuously between Acre and the Beni. But they cannot be sure, because between Acre and the Beni is the Department of Pando, which is mostly forested. Nor do they know whether the geoglyphs served any function. One of Walker's earthworks was connected to a nearby river by a deep channel and had a connection to a swamp on the other side, he said to me. It could have been used to control water flow off of the savanna in the dry season, so at least some of these earthworks could have had a hydraulic function. But most of the geoglyphs in Acre are on higher ground, making them of little use for drainage. Many have outer walls that look down on the central area, suggesting that they were not used for defense. And they are sometimes almost entirely without other traces of the human presence, such as middens. The immediate response is that they were symbolic places, according to Peter Stahl, an anthropologist at the State University of New York, Binghamton. But that's the old archaeological canard. If you can't figure out the function of something, you say it was for ritual. Most geoglyphs seem to be late, dating to only a few hundred years before Columbus. The ubiquity of the geoglyphs may indicate that some type of cultural movement swept over earlier social arrangements. But whatever was there, these societies have been completely forgotten, said Guillermo Roja, an anthropologist who is director of sustainable development and indigenous peoples for the prefecture of the Pando. It's only been 400 years since they vanished, he told me. Why does nobody here know anything about them? They were living here for such a long time, and nobody knows who they were. The room we were meeting in was full of photographs of deep forest. Roja said, "We have to take care of this place." He said, "These people apparently developed a set of tools that let them take charge of the environment while not ruining it for the future, for us." He said, "We have much to learn here. Who knows what else we might find out?" Raindrop physics. The papaya orchard was so robust and healthy that it looked like an advertisement. The background image behind a celebrity endorser of a new papaya drink. Sweating in the equatorial sun, some of the researchers admiringly fingered the plump, pendulous green fruit, each the size of a baby's head, wrapped in clusters around the tree's sturdy trunks. Other scientists bent down and with equal approbation scooped up handfuls of dirt. The road to the plantation had been cut into the Amazon's famously poor soil. It was the blaring orange-red of cheap makeup, almost surreally bright against the great, dark green leaves of the forest. But in the shade of the papaya trees, the soil was dark brown, with the moist, friable feel that gardeners seek. At first glance, the soil seemed similar to what one would find in, say, the grain belts of North America or Europe. After a more careful inspection, though, it looked entirely different, because it was full of broken ceramics. The combination of good soil, successful agriculture, and evidence of past Indian inhabitation was what had brought the scientists to the farm. I had been invited to tag along. The orchard was about 1,000 miles up the Amazon, 2 hours by ferry and bus from Manaus. Manaus, the biggest city on the river, is situated on the north bank of the Amazon, hard by its junction with the Negro River, a major tributary. The river's main channel is in this area called the Solimões. English language maps usually put Manaus at the meeting of the Negro and the Solimões, with the latter changing its name back to Amazon upstream. Brazilian maps say that the Amazon begins at the conjunction of the Negro and the Solimões. Between the two rivers is a tongue of land that, depending on your point of view, is either almost destroyed by development or quite lightly inhabited considering its proximity to a city of 1 million people. Near the tip of the tongue is the small village of Iranduba, a bush pilot airport, a half dozen lackadaisical stores, some bars with jukeboxes loud enough to knock birds from the trees, and docks for loading local farmers' produce. A few miles outside Iranduba, on a bluff above the Amazon, stood the papaya orchard. It was one of the many small riverside farms operated by the descendants of Japanese immigrants. In 1994, Michael Heckenberger, of the University of Florida in Gainesville, and James B. Peterson, of the University of Vermont in Burlington, decided to look for potential archaeological sites in the central Amazon. With a team of Brazilian scientists, Meggers had surveyed much of the river and its tributaries in the 1970s and 1980s and concluded there was little of archaeological relevance, further proof of the inescapability of ecological constraints. Believing that Meggers' survey had been too coarse-grained, Heckenberger and Peterson decided to search a single area intensively. Joined by Eduardo Goes Neves of the University of Sao Paulo, several dozen of Neves' students, and later, Robert N. Bartone of the University of Maine at Farmington. They found more than 30 sites at the Amazon-Negro Junction, four of which they excavated fully. The papaya farm was one of the four. Now Nevis, Peterson, and Bartone were leading a score of visiting researchers and a journalist on a tour of the site. From the shade of a doorway, the father of the family watched us mill around with a tolerant smile. A teenage girl stood outside, listlessly sweeping at a cloud of yellow butterflies. Through the loosely placed boards in the wall floated the bark and jabber of a talk radio show about the latest soccer perfidy from Argentina, Brazil's hated rival. Although it was winter, the midday sun was hot enough to make sweat start out from the skin. At the edge of the papaya grove were 10 low earthen mounds that the team had identified as human-made. Carbon dating indicated that they were constructed in about 1000 AD. The archaeologists had begun opening up the largest of the mounds. Already, they had discovered 9 burials, one body placed in a big funerary urn, all apparently interred at the same time. Because the scientists were unlikely to have uncovered the area's only concentration of human remains in their first exploratory test pit, they believed that the entire mound was likely to be full of burials, hundreds of them. "That suggests thousands of people lived here," Nevis said. "In 1000 AD, that's a big place." Shoving back his baseball cap, Nevis levered himself into the excavation site. A 6-foot, rectangular hole with the right-angled corners and precisely vertical walls that are a hallmark of archaeological investigation. One of the visiting researchers passed down a Munsell soil color chart. Resembling strips of paint color samples, these are used by pedologists, soil scientists, to classify soils. Nevis scraped the wall lightly, exposing fresh earth, and pinned the chart to the wall with a big-headed nail. From the top of the dig, he dangled a measuring tape, alternating 10-centimeter strips of red, white, and green to indicate depth. Digital cameras ratcheted and whined. It was a vest pocket version of the inspection of Folsom by the Greybeards. Nevis had a little trouble hanging the tape because he couldn't find a place where it wouldn't get snagged on the broken ceramics protruding from the walls. They bristled from the side of the dig in a profusion that reminded me of the Beni Mounds, hundreds of miles upstream. Some of the pieces seemed to form horizontal layers. As in the Beni, the ceramics had apparently been smashed deliberately, perhaps to build up the surface. I asked Peterson, a ceramics specialist, how many plates and bowls and cups were in the mounds. He pulled out a scrap of paper and a pen and scribbled some numbers. In a minute or two, he looked up. "This is a rough, back-of-the-envelope type estimate," he warned, showing me the result. "The single mound we were standing on might contain more than 40 million potsherds." "Think of the industry required to produce that much pottery," Nevis said. "Then they just smash it. Look at the way they piled up this good soil to make the burial mound. It's all wasteful behavior." "I don't think scarcity was a problem here." The ecological constraints on tropical soils are in large part due to the gravitational energy of raindrops. Rainfall, drumming down day in and day out, pounds the top few inches of earth into slurry, from which nutrients are easily leached and which itself easily washes away. In uncut forest, the canopy intercepts precipitation, absorbing the physical impact of its fall from the clouds. The water eventually spills from the leaves, but it hits the ground less violently. When farmers or loggers clear the tree cover, droplets shoot at the ground with more than twice as much force. Slash and burn minimizes the time in which the ground is unprotected. Intensive agriculture is much more productive, but maximizes the land's exposure. This painful trade-off is why ecologists argue that any attempt by tropical forest societies to grow beyond small villages has always been doomed to fail. According to Charles R. Clement, the Manaus botanist, though, the first Amazonians did avoid the dilemma of rainfall physics. Speaking broadly, their solution was not to clear the forest, but to replace it with one adapted to human use. They set up shop on the bluffs that mark the edge of high water, close enough to the river to fish, far enough to avoid the flood. And then, rather than centering their agriculture on annual crops, they focus on the Amazon's wildly diverse assortment of trees. In his view, the Amazon's first inhabitants laboriously cleared small plots with their stone axes. But rather than simply planting manioc and other annual crops in their gardens until the forest took them over, they planted selected tree crops along with the manioc and managed the transition. Of the 138 known domesticated plant species in the Amazon, more than half are trees. Depending on the definition of domesticated, the figure could be as high as 80%. Sapodilla, calabash, and tucuma, babassu, acai, and wild pineapple, cocoa palm, American oil palm, and Panama hat palm. The Amazon's wealth of fruits, nuts, and palms is justly celebrated. Visitors are always amazed that you can walk in the forest here and constantly pick fruit from trees, Clemens said. That's because people planted them. They're walking through old orchards. Peach palms, the trees through which I looked at the Amazon from Painted Rock Cave, are Clemens' favorite example. Giddily tall and straight, they have up to a dozen stalks, with a protective mat of spikes wrapped around the bottom of the tree. The protection is little needed. Peach palm wood is hard enough that in the Beni, it was used for saw blades. Bundles of orange or red fruit hang like clusters of bocce balls from the base of the fronds. The fruit is soaked with oil and rich in beta-carotene, vitamin C, and surprisingly, protein. When dried, the whiter pink pulp makes flour for thin, tortilla-like cakes. When boiled and smoked, it becomes hors d'oeuvres. When cooked and fermented, it makes beer. The sap also makes a kind of wine. Two crops a year are not uncommon. In terms of yield per acre, peach palms are typically much more productive than rice, beans, or maize. Trees begin producing fruit after 3 to 5 years and can continue for another 70 years. Like strawberries, peach palm throws out adventitious shoots. With a little care, these can be harvested for heart of palm. Very tasty heart of palm, in my experience. Batric gasipes, as scientists call it, has more than 200 common names. Pupuna, Cajipe, Tembe, Pejibaya, Chontaduro, Piwayo. To Clement, the proliferation of names suggests the plant was used for many purposes by many cultures. In the 1980s and early 1990s, Clement measured peach palms throughout the Amazon basin. He learned that several physical characteristics, including fruit size, lay on a gradient with those apparently closest to the wild state in western Amazonia, near the Beni. The implication was that the tree might first have been cultivated there. Using a different method, Jorge Moriopi, one of Clemens's collaborators, concluded that Indians might have bred the modern peach palm by hybridizing palms from several areas, including the Peruvian Amazon. Whatever the origin, people domesticated the species thousands of years ago and then spread it rapidly. First through Amazonia, and then up into the Caribbean and Central America. Batris gasipes was in Costa Rica 1700 to 2300 years ago, and probably earlier. By the time of Columbus, one 17th century observer wrote, Native Americans valued it so highly that only their wives and children were held in higher regard. Unlike maize or manioc, peach palm can thrive with no human attention. Tragically, this quality has proven to be enormously useful. In the 17th and 18th centuries, many Amazonian Indians, the Yanomamo among them, abandoned their farm villages, which had made them sitting ducks for European diseases and slave trading. They hid out in the forest, preserving their freedom by moving from place to place. In what Belay calls agricultural regression, these hunted peoples necessarily gave up farming and kept body and soul together by foraging. The Stone Age tribespeople in the Amazon wilderness that captured so many European imaginations were in large part a European creation and a historical novelty. They survived because the wilderness was largely composed of their ancestors' orchards. These old forests, called fallows, have traditionally been classified as high forest, pristine forest on well-drained ground, by Western researchers. Belay wrote in 2003, but they would not exist without human agricultural activities. Indeed, Amazonians typically do not make the distinction between cultivated and wild landscapes common in the West. Instead, they simply classify landscapes into scores of varieties, depending on the types of species in each. After we had spoken for a while, Clement took me out of his office and into INPA's, IMPA's, experimental forest. To my untrained eye, it looked much the same as the forests around the lodges outside Manaus that attract ecotourists, except that IMPA staffers kept down the undergrowth. There was the same cool green light from the canopy, the same refulgent smell, the same awe-inspiring sense of variety. The air vibrated with the same inharmonic racket of squealing, burbling, croaking, and cheeping birds. Dribbling down some of the tree trunks were little runnels that looked like dried sap. On a previous visit to the Amazon, I had seen runnels just like these on a rubber tree in an abandoned plantation. Thinking it was a drip of latex sap, I plucked at one. It was the cover for a termite superhighway. Termites boiled out of the little tunnel and all over my hand. Termites bite. Flapping my hand wildly, I leapt back from the tree. My sandaled foot landed on a ground wasp nest. In this way, I learned why some Amazonians have a jaundiced view of biodiversity. On Clement's tour, I kept my hands to myself. It was July, winter in the Amazon, the worst time of the year for fruit. Nevertheless, Clement was able to find yellow bakery and purple acai. He plucked what looked like a 4-foot version of a string bean from a branch, split it lengthwise, and showed me flattened, shiny seeds arrayed along its length like teeth in a jaw. Each seed was the size of a thumb bone and nestled in a fluffy white coating. "Try this," he said. "It's the ice cream bean." I put a seed in my mouth and sucked on it. The coating did taste quite like vanilla ice cream and was just as refreshing. 3 or 4 more fruits followed, each equally strange to me. This is what people like about biodiversity. Peach palm was not in season, but he found another member of the same genus. The fruit, when peeled, was unappetizing, quite like soggy cardboard in color, texture, and flavor. Clement squeezed some pulp. Oil dribbled from his fingers to the ground. "This'll put some calories into you," he said. Planting their orchards for millennia, the first Amazonians slowly transformed large swaths of the river basin into something more pleasing to human beings. In the country inhabited by the Kaapor, on the mainland southeast of Marajá, centuries of tinkering have profoundly changed the forest community. In Kaapor-managed forests, according to Belay's plant inventories, almost half of the ecologically important species are those used by humans for food. In similar forests that have not recently been managed, the figure is only 20%. Belay cautiously estimated, in a widely cited article published in 1989, that at least 11.8%, about an eighth of the non-flooded Amazon forest, was anthropogenic, directly or indirectly created by humans. Some researchers today regard this figure as conservative. "I basically think it's all human-created," Clement told me. So does Erickson, the University of Pennsylvania archaeologist who told me in Bolivia that the lowland tropical forests of South America are among the finest works of art on the planet. "Some of my colleagues would say that's pretty radical," he said. According to Peter Stahl, an anthropologist at the State University of New York in Binghamton, lots of researchers believe that what the eco-imagery would like to picture as a pristine, untouched Urwelt, primeval world, in fact has been managed by people for millennia. The phrase built environment, Erickson argued, applies to most, if not all, neotropical landscapes. Gift from the past. Landscape, in this case, is meant exactly. Amazonian Indians literally created the ground beneath their feet. According to Susanna Hecht, the UCLA geographer, researchers into upland Amazonia took most of their soil samples along the region's highways, which indeed passed through areas with awful soil. Some regions were so saturated with toxic aluminum that they are now being mined for bauxite. A few scientists, though, found patches of something better. In part because of the empty Amazon model, Hecht told me, these were seen as anomalous and insignificant. But in the 1990s, researchers began studying these unusual regions of Terra Preta de Indio, rich, fertile, Indian dark earth that anthropologists believe was made by human beings. Throughout Amazonia, farmers prize Terra Preta for its great productivity. Some have worked it for years with minimal fertilization. Among them are the owners of the papaya orchard I visited, who have happily grown crops on their Terra Preta for two decades. More surprising still, the ceramics in the farm's Terra Preta indicate that the soil has retained its nutrients for as much as a millennium. On a local level, Terra Preta is valuable enough for locals to dig it up and sell as potting soil. An activity that, alas, has already destroyed countless artifacts. To the consternation of archaeologists, long planters full of ancient Terra Preta, complete with pre-Columbian potsherds, greet visitors to the Santarém airport. Because Terra Preta is subject to the same punishing conditions as the surrounding bad soils, its existence is very surprising, according to Bruno Glaser, a chemist at the Institute of Soil Science and Soil Geography at the University of Bayreuth, Germany. If you read the textbooks, it shouldn't be there. Terra Preta exists in two forms: Terra Preta itself, a black soil thick with pottery, and Terra Mulata, a lighter dark brown soil with much less pottery. A number of researchers believe that although Indians made both, they deliberately created only the Terra Mulata. Terra Preta was the soil created directly around homes by charcoal kitchen fires and organic refuse of various types. I use Terra Preta loosely to cover both. Because careful surveys of Amazon soils have never been taken, nobody knows the amount and distribution of Terra Preta. Woods has guessed that Terra Preta might represent as much as 10% of the Amazon basin, an area the size of France. A recent, much more conservative estimate is that it covers 0.1 to 0.3% of the basin, a few thousand square miles. The big difference between these numbers matters less than one might expect. A few thousand square miles of farmland was enough to feed the millions in the Maya heartland. Most big Terra Preta sites are on low bluffs at the edge of the floodplain. Typically, they cover 5 to 15 acres, but some encompass 700 or more. The layer of black soil is generally 1 to 2 feet deep, but can reach more than 6 feet. According to a recent study led by Durst Kern of the Museo Goeldi in Belém, Terra Preta is not associated with a particular parent soil type or environmental condition, suggesting that it was not produced by natural processes. Another clue to its human origin is the broken ceramics with which it is usually mixed. They practiced agriculture here for centuries, Glaser told me. But instead of destroying the soil, they improved it, and that is something we don't know how to do today in tropical soils. As a rule, Terra Preta has more plant-available phosphorus, calcium, sulfur, and nitrogen than is common in the rainforest. It also has much more organic matter, better retains moisture and nutrients, and is not rapidly exhausted by agricultural use when managed well. The key to Terra Preta's long-term fertility, Glaser says, is charcoal. Terra Preta contains up to 64 times more of it than surrounding red earth. Organic matter sticks to charcoal, rather than being washed away or attaching to other non-available compounds. Over time, it partly oxidizes, which keeps providing sites for nutrients to bind to. But simply mixing charcoal into the ground is not enough to create Terra Preta. Because charcoal contains few nutrients, Glaser argued, high nutrient inputs, excrement, and waste such as turtle, fish, and animal bones are necessary. Special soil microorganisms are also likely to play a role in its persistent fertility. In 2010, a Brazilian U.S. team of archaeologists, soil scientists, and molecular biologists found that Terra Preta had as much as 100 times more bacteria than adjacent soils, and that these bacteria were almost completely different from those nearby. Many species were apparently new to science, and even those that seemed familiar were surprising. Some were usually restricted to tropical rice paddies. Such findings raise the possibility that scientists might be able to create a package of charcoal, nutrients, and microfauna that could be used to transform bad tropical soil into Terra Preta. Despite the charcoal, Terra Preta is not a byproduct of slash-and-burn agriculture. To begin with, slash-and-burn simply does not produce enough charcoal to make Terra Preta. The carbon mostly goes into the air in the form of carbon dioxide. Instead, Indians apparently made Terra Preta by a process that the soil scientist Christoph Steiner has dubbed slash-and-char. Instead of completely burning organic matter to ash, ancient farmers burned it incompletely to make charcoal, then stirred the charcoal into the soil. In addition to its benefits to the soil, slash and char releases much less carbon into the air than slash and burn, which has large potential implications for climate change. Trees store vast amounts of carbon in their trunks, branches, and leaves. When they die, or people cut them down, the carbon is usually released into the atmosphere, driving global warming. Experiments by Makoto Ogawa of the Kansai Environmental Engineering Center near Kyoto, Japan, demonstrated that charcoal retains its carbon in the soil for up to 50,000 years. Slash and char is very clever, Ogawa told me. Nobody in Europe or Asia that I know of ever understood the properties of charcoal in soil. Indians are still making Terra Preta in this way, according to Hecht, the UCLA geographer. Hecht spent years with the Kayapo in central Amazonia, watching them create low biomass fires cool enough to walk through, of pulled up weeds, cooking waste, crop debris, palm fronds, and termite mounds. Burning, she wrote, is constant. To live among the Kayapo is to live in a place where parts of the landscape smolder. Hecht regards Indian fire as an essential part of the Amazonian landscape, as it was in the forests of eastern North America. We've got to get over this whole Bambi syndrome, she told me, referring to the movie's forest fire scene, which has taught generations of children that burning wildlands is evil. Let the Kayapo burn the rainforest. They know what they're doing. In a preliminary test run at creating Terra Preta, Steiner, Venceslau Teixeira, of the Brazilian Agricultural Research Enterprise, and Wolfgang Zesch, of the University of Bayreuth, applied a variety of treatments involving charcoal and fertilizer for 3 years to rice and sorghum plots outside Manaus. In the first year, there was little difference among the treatments, except for the control plots, in which almost nothing grew. By the second year, Steiner said, the charcoal was really making a difference. Plots with charcoal alone grew little, but those treated with a combination of charcoal and fertilizer yielded as much as 880% more than plots with fertilizer alone. His Terra Preta was this productive Steiner told me. Despite making no attempt to recreate the ancient microbial balance. Beginning a little more than 2,000 years ago, the central and lower Amazon were rocked by extreme cultural change. Arawak-speaking groups migrated in from the south and west, sometimes apparently driving Tupi-speaking groups north and east. Sedentary villages appeared, and so did Terra Preta. No one yet knows if or how these events were related. By about the time of Christ, the central Amazon had at least some large settled villages. Nevis, Peterson, and Bartone excavated one on a high bank about 30 miles up the Rio Negro. Judging by carbon dating and the sequence of ceramics, they believe the site was inhabited in two waves. From about 360 BC, when Terra Preta formation began, to as late as 1440 AD. We haven't finished working, but there seems to be a central plaza and some defensive ditches there, Peterson told me in a conversation before his death in 2005. The plaza was at least a quarter mile long, the ditch more than 300 feet long and up to 18 feet wide and 6 feet deep. A big permanent settlement. Terra Preta showed up at the papaya plantation between 620 and 720 AD. By that time, it seems to have been underneath villages throughout the central Amazon. Several hundred years later, it reached the upper Xingu, a long Amazon tributary with its headwaters deep in southern Brazil. People had lived around the Xingu for a long time, but around 1100 or 1200 AD, Arawak-speaking people appear to have moved in, jostling shoulders with people who spoke a Tupi Guarani language. In 2003, Heckenberger, who had worked with Peterson and Nevis, announced in Science that in this area he and his colleagues had turned up remains of 19 large villages linked by a network of wide roads, in a remarkably elaborate regional plan. Around these settlements, which were in place between approximately 1250 and 1400 AD, the Xinguanos built bridges, artificial river obstructions, and ponds, raised causeways, canals, and other structures. A highly elaborate built environment, rivaling that of many contemporary complex societies of the Americas and elsewhere. The earlier inhabitants left no trace of Terra Preta. The new villages quickly set down thick deposits of black earth. To me, Wood said, it looks as if someone invented it, and the technique spread to the neighbors. One of the biggest patches of Terra Preta is on the high bluffs at the mouth of the Tapajós, near Santarém. First mapped in the 1960s by the late Wim Sombroek, director of the International Soil Reference and Information Center in Wageningen, the Netherlands. The Terra Preta zone is 3 miles long and half a mile wide, suggesting widespread human habitation, exactly what Oriana saw. The plateau has never been carefully excavated, but observations by geographers Woods and Joseph McCann of the New School in New York City indicate that it is thick with ceramics. If the agriculture practiced in the lower Tapajós were as intensive as in the most complex cultures in pre-contact North America, Woods told me, you'd be talking something capable of supporting about 200,000 to 400,000 people, making it at the time one of the most densely populated places in the world. Woods was part of an international consortium of scientists studying Terra Preta. If its secrets could be unraveled, he said, it might improve the expanses of bad soil that cripple agriculture in Africa. A final gift from the peoples who brought us tomatoes, maize, manioc, and 1,000 different ways of being human. Betty Meggers would just die if she heard me saying this, Woods told me. Deep down, her fear is that this data will be misused. In 2001, Meggers charged in an article in Latin American Antiquity that archaeologists' claims that the Amazon could support intensive agriculture were effectively telling developers that they are entitled to operate without restraint. These researchers had thus become unwitting accomplices in the accelerating pace of environmental degradation. Centuries after the conquistadors, she lamented, the myth of El Dorado is being revived by archaeologists. Doubtless her political anxieties are not without justification, although, as some of her sparring partners observed, it is difficult to imagine greedy plutocrats perusing the pages of Latin American antiquity before deciding to rev up the chainsaws. But the new picture doesn't automatically legitimate burning down the forest. Instead, it suggests that for a long time, clever people who knew tricks that we have yet to learn used big chunks of Amazonia non-destructively. Faced with an ecological problem, the Indians fixed it. Rather than adapt to nature, they created it. They were in the midst of terraforming the Amazon when Columbus showed up and ruined everything. Chapter 10. The Artificial Wilderness. 1,000 kudzus everywhere. Until about 200 million years ago, Eurasia and the Americas were lashed together in a single landmass that geologists call Pangaea. Pangaea broke into pieces, sending the continents drifting like barges across the ocean floor. For millions of years, the separate fragments of Pangaea had almost no communication. Evolution set their species spinning off on separate trajectories, and the flora and fauna of each land diverged so far from each other that the astounded Columbus remarked that all the trees were as different from ours as day from night, and so the fruits, the herbage, the rocks, and all things. Columbus was the first to see the yawning biological gap between Europe and the Americas. He was also one of the last to see it in pure form. His visit, as Alfred Crosby put it, initiated the process of knitting together the seams of Pangaea. Ever since 1492, the hemispheres have become more and more alike, as people mix the world's organisms into a global stew. Thus, bananas and coffee, two African crops, became the principal agricultural exports of Central America. Maize and manioc, domesticated in Mesoamerica and Amazonia, respectively, returned the favor by becoming staples in tropical Africa. Meanwhile, plantations of rubber trees, an Amazon native, undulate across Malaysian hillsides. Peppers and tomatoes from Mesoamerica form the culinary backbones of Thailand and Italy. Andean potatoes led Ireland to feast and famine. And apples, native to the Middle East, appear in markets from Manaus to Manila to Manhattan. Back in 1972, Crosby invented a term for this biological ferment, the Columbian Exchange. By knitting together the seams of Pangaea, Columbus set off an ecological explosion of a magnitude unseen since the Ice Ages. Some species were shocked into decline. Most prominent among them, Homo sapiens, which in the century and a half after Columbus lost a fifth of its number, mainly to disease. Others stumbled into new ecosystems and were transformed into environmental overlords. Picture book illustrations of what scientists call ecological release. In ecological release, an organism escapes its home and parachutes into an ecosystem that has never encountered it before. The majority of such escapees die rapidly, unable to thrive or reproduce in novel surroundings. Most of the survivors find a quiet niche and settle in, blending inconspicuously with the locals. But a few, finding themselves in places with few or none of their natural enemies, look around with the hopeful incredulity of juvenile delinquents who discover the mall's security cameras are broken and wreak havoc. In their home ecosystems, these species have, like all living things, a full complement of parasites, microbes, viruses, and insect predators to shorten and immiserate their lives. Suddenly free of this burden, they can burst out and overwhelm the landscape. The Japanese grind the roots of a low vine called kuzu, Pueria lobata, into a white powder that thickens soup and is alleged to have curative properties. They also plant the species on highway shoulders as erosion-preventing ground cover. In the 1930s, the U.S. Civilian Conservation